Well, I want to say I'm thrilled and honored to introduce Noam Chomsky as the first speaker in our inaugural Governing Board Symposium, which is entitled The Biology of Language in the 21st Century. And of course, Professor Chomsky needs no introduction as he's the most eminent figure in cognitive science of our time. I suspect many people in this room cut their teeth on Chomsky's writings, and for most of us, reading those works convinced us that we wanted to spend our lives working on the science of human language and, more broadly, functions of the mind. I won't say any more. However, I will note that despite his towering role in our field, strangely enough, this is, I believe, Dr. Chomsky's first time coming to a meeting of the CogSci Society. So we're especially grateful that he's agreed to speak to us today, and because he's a first-timer, we agreed to waive his registration.
No bells and whistles, so I won't be using any of that stuff. I might ask you to think about a few sentences, which if I was well organized, I'd put up there, but I'm not well organized. What I'd like to do is review some general conclusions that I think about language and cognition that I think can be put forth with reasonable confidence, and also to talk about some of the consequences that follow from them, assuming they're correct. The framework I'll be assuming is began to take shape about 60 years ago. It's been called sometimes the generative enterprise, call it that. The generative enterprise focused attention on a crucial property of languages that had actually been largely overlooked, in fact, almost totally, namely the crucial fact that each language yields, in some manner, an infinite array of structured expressions, each of which provides what we might think of as instructions to two interfaces with other cognitive systems. The sensory motor system for externalization and the what's called the conceptual intentional system, intentional with a T, not an S. I'll just call it the CI system because that's too hard to say on a hot day. So it gives instructions to both of those systems. Now that's sort of the core of language. The CI systems include thought, planning, interpretation of actions, and so on and so forth. The in this respect, a language satisfies, although I'll qualify this later, it satisfies a common sense characterization of language, which goes back to Aristotle, that a language is a sound with a meaning. I'll come back to that. The fact that it's an infinite array is sort of trivial and obvious, but I can't find any recognition of the fact up until the 17th century scientific revolution, where it was discussed and by Galileo, Descartes, and it played a rather significant role. Before that, doesn't seem to have been mentioned. Well, it follows just from this that each language is in effect a generative process that produces that infinite array of expressions and the mappings to the interfaces. We can think of the generative process as being a language, and it's sometimes called an I language, I standing for internal, individual, and intentional, this time with an S, meaning you care about the actual nature of the procedure, the algorithm, not just the class of structured expressions that it generates. So that's an I language. There are many notions of language, but I think this one is kind of central in a way because it's presupposed, at least tacitly, in every approach to language, even those that hotly deny it. I think that can be shown. Well, this internalist approach to language was kind of embedded back in the early 50s in the developing effort to regard language as a biological system, which came to be called later the biolinguistic framework. According to this approach, a language is a subsystem of the organism, mostly the brain, which is like other subsystems of the organism, some system which have a certain degree of internal integration, enough so that you can study it independently and you can study its interactions with other systems. So in this respect, it's like the visual system, the digestive system, the circulatory system, the immune system. You can't cut it out of the body, but it's an integrated system that interacts with others and can be studied on its own. This approach to language fits what Randy Galestel called the biological norm, namely modular systems with special growth learning mechanisms, I'm paraphrasing him, in different domains and in different species. And I think there's every reason to expect that human language will fit that biological norm. It seems to have properties that are probably unique in the organic world. It also seems to have emerged quite recently in evolutionary time, I'll come back to that, millions of years after the separation of humans from any surviving species. There seems to be no analog anywhere, that, as far as I know, for a generative procedure with mapping to interfaces, which is what a language essentially is. Well, as in every case of growth and development, this system relies on several different factors. One of them is external data. The second is a genetic component. And a third is general principles of physics, chemistry, and so on, general principles of natural law, which always play a crucial role in growth and development and, of course, evolution. The first factor is whatever the child's exposed to, just data. The second factor, the genetic component, for a cognitive system maps data to experience, which is a non-trivial operation, not well understood, and then sets the general framework in which growth and development takes place. The third factor in the case of language, since language is a computational system, eye language clearly is a computational system, the third factor one would expect, and I think we find, relies extensively on principles of computational efficiency that may ultimately reduce to laws of nature. Well, particular language, we can, any language, we can disarticulate the second factor, the genetic component, into sub-factors. One of them is whatever specific to the faculty of language, so the genetic component of the language faculty. That's in the last 50 years or so, it's been called a universal grammar, or UG, that's taking a traditional term and giving it rather new interpretation. So the theory of the genetic component of the language faculty. The second factor that enters into growth and development is genetic factor is other cognitive systems that interact with UG. And the third is, I think we find quite generally, principles of efficient computation. About a half a century ago, and when all this stuff began, the general view of, concerning language was that only the second component of the genetic factor functions, only other cognitive processes. So no UG, no genetic component to the language faculty, and there was no resort to, except tacitly, to principles of efficient computation or other elements of natural law. So for example, the most influential philosopher of the time who wrote about these topics, W.V. Quine at Harvard, for him, a language is nothing but, quoting him, a fabric of sentences variously associated to one another and to nonverbal stimuli by the mechanism of conditioned response. So it's a rather accidental construct, depending on the accidental course of experience. It could vary all over the place, and there's nothing general that you could say about it, which in fact was his conclusion. Other prominent philosophers held that it would be enough to resort to general learning mechanisms unspecified in order to account for the acquisition of language. All of these approaches took for granted that language doesn't exist as an object of independent scientific inquiry. If there's no universal grammar, no theory of the genetic component, then essentially there's no language, just some random collection or some collection of behaviors which we'll decide to look at in the same category for some reason, but no object of serious inquiry. I'll, for short, call this the non-existence approach to language. Well, within professional linguistics, the attitude was quite similar. So one standard conception, I'll quote from major figure, was that languages can differ from each other without limit and in unpredictable ways, and therefore the study of each language must be approached without any pre-existent scheme of what a language is. That's Martin Joseph's formulation of what he called the Boasian tradition, the dominant tradition in American structural linguistics. European linguistics was not very different. The most important, more or less theoretical work in the field at the time was Zelig Harris's book, Methods in Structural Linguistics. It was called, 1951, it was called Methods because the assumption was that there isn't much to say about language. The only thing you can say is here are some methods which you can use to reduce a corpus of material, a collection of data, to an organized form. Doing it, how you do it, depends on what your purposes are. Structural linguistics, Europe and here, focused on phonology and morphology, which do happen to be the areas in which languages differ quite substantially, at least on the surface, and in complex ways. I'll come back to that fact. But the search for what was sometimes called God's truth linguistics, that is, going beyond organizing data in some way, that was typically ridiculed, as the term implies. Well, actually, in general biology, there was a rather similar conception at the time and for many years later. It was captured well by molecular biologist Gunter Stent. He concluded that the variability of organisms is so free as to constitute a near infinitude of particulars which have to be sorted out case by case. That's analogous to the what was called the Boasian tradition. That conception has almost totally disappeared, so dramatically, in fact, that one can now seriously consider a proposal by biochemist Michael Sherman that there might be, I'm quoting him, a universal genome that encodes all major developmental programs essential for the various phyla of metazoa that emerged at the time of the Cambrian explosion. So from this perspective, there's really only one organism, plant or animal, from an appropriately abstract point of view. And what we actually find are just various arrangements of a developmental genetic toolkit preserved through a long course of evolution, billions of years. Well, although the variation without limits conception has virtually disappeared from general biology, the rather similar non-existence idea still reverberates, still very much alive with regard to language. So, for example, I'll quote a recent article in Science magazine, which holds that there are well-developed gradualist evolutionary arguments that language is entirely grounded in a constellation of cognitive capacities that each taken separately has other functions as well. In that case, language exists only in the sense that, say, today's weather exists. It's a constellation of factors that have independent functions, not an object of serious scientific inquiry. Other concerns, but not scientific inquiry. An influential view in language acquisition, a highly influential one, is that language acquisition is simply a matter of learning symbols that are used in communication. The symbols could be words, idioms, this sentence that I'm now saying, all basically on a par, and by acquired by means that are available to all primates. Maybe we do it a little faster or something like that. A rather arbitrary collection. So it could be almost anything, depending on the on experience. Somehow becomes unbounded by unspecified methods of analogy or induction, which somehow overcomes that problem, but they're not stated. This non-existence approach, also I should say that in computational cognitive science, this central approach is pretty dominant. And these studies have a merit. They're clear enough so that you can evaluate them. And I think it can be shown, I've written about this elsewhere, as of others, it can be shown, I think, that every one of them is a dramatic failure. If it tries to deal in any way with the nature of language. I'll come back to a couple of examples. Well, UG, universal grammar, is not to be confused with something different. It's often confused with descriptive generalizations about language, such as, for those of you who know the field, Joseph Greenberg's universals. It's a very, about 40, 50 years ago, a very useful collection of quite good descriptive generalizations about a wide variety of languages. And it's an important topic. It's given rise to plenty of valuable inquiry in current journals, but it's a different topic. So putting aside possible genetic variation among individuals, which is not relevant here, the principles of UG are uniform. They're the same for every human. They're invariant. And they're typically not exhibited directly in phenomena, just like other principles. It's same with all biological systems. For example, you don't exhibit in performance, in ordinary observed behavior, you don't exhibit such things as, Shimon-Ullman's rigidity principle, which accounts for the interpretation of a few successive tachistoscopic presentations of a few dots as a rigid object in motion. It's a principle of perception, but you don't see it in the data. You've got to discover it. It's not so easy. And the same is true of UG. You don't see it in the data. On the other hand, descriptive generalizations, and these are not going to vary. If they're right, they're going to be uniform, apart from pathology. Descriptive generalizations, on the other hand, you expect to have exceptions. That's perfectly normal. Discovery of such exceptions is often a very valuable stimulus to further inquiry. That's standard in the sciences, just to mention one classic case. When perturbations were discovered in the orbit of Uranus, scientists didn't say, okay, let's throw out Kepler's generalizations and Newton's laws. In fact, let's throw out science altogether and just collect data. On the contrary, what they did is ask what the reason is for they assumed that the theories were correct, which was a good enough assumption for the time, and asked what accounted for the deviations from the principles. And of course, they found something, namely Neptune. And that's pretty standard. Exceptions to largely valid generalizations are, they play a similar role throughout the sciences. Unfortunately, that isn't understood too well in cognitive science and linguistics. There are many recent examples. In fact, within the generative enterprise, exceptions have driven a great deal of significant inquiry. In fact, they're sometimes even identified as exceptions because they're so important. So something called exceptional case marking, or the extended projection principle, which means exceptions to the projection principle. It's the kind of exceptions to generally valid generalizations that open up tasks for serious inquiry. Now, there's a sensible approach to violation of generally valid principles. It's captured by a remark by Eric Roiland, well-known linguist. He's talking about early proposals for binding theory, the theory of essentially referential dependence, you know, an anaphor like each other referring to some antecedent. What he, talking about these early proposals, he said, they're too bad to be true and they're too good to be false. And that's probably the right way to look at these things. He and others then proceeded to identify and explore various factors that give a more complete picture. A recent book just came out, but maintaining a good bit of the spirit of the original. Well, actually, binding theory offers some useful lessons on taking principles and exceptions seriously. So the earliest proposals, maybe 35 years ago, they proposed that anaphoric relations, referential dependency, depended on linear order, the order in which things occur. But it was shown persuasively back in the late 1970s that linearity ordering doesn't seem to play any role in the core principles of binding theory. They just depend on hierarchy and structure. That is an interesting observation. I'm going to come back to it. It suggests a much more far-reaching thesis, which has plenty of consequences, namely that order and other arrangements are a peripheral part of language. They result from the kind of a reflex of the fact that it's externalized in the sensory motor system. That, of course, requires some kind of order or other kinds of organization, but they don't apply at all in the core computational operations of the syntax and the semantics, whatever feeds the conceptual intentional interface. I'll return to that, but keep in mind, if it's true, it has a lot of consequences. And this is one kind of evidence that suggests that it's true. Binding theory also is one of the very rare examples of a significant property of language that has been addressed within the non-existence approach without just hand-waving. I'm referring actually to a recent paper in Cognitive Science by Chater and Christensen. So here I'll have to ask you to keep some sentences in mind, simple ones. So take the sentence, do they expect to talk to each other? Well, here the word they is the antecedent of each other. That means, do each of them expect to talk to the others? Chater and Christensen propose that this anaphoric relation, I'll quote them, is simply an instance of a general cognitive tendency to resolve ambiguities rapidly in linguistic and perceptual input. So if that's correct, the facts would be due to an innate constraint, but not one that's specific to language. Well, actually, counterexamples to this idea have been in the literature for decades, and pursuing them has led to important insights. I'll give you a couple of examples to illustrate. So suppose you take that sentence, do they expect to talk to each other, and suppose you insert John in it. So do they expect John to talk to each other? Well, then the quickest way to find the anaphor is, again, to take they to be the antecedent, because John can't be, but obviously that's wrong. Similarly, if I say they gave a picture of the men to each other, the closest legitimate antecedent is men. That's the closest plural that could be an antecedent, but obviously that's not what the sentence means. Can't play that role. So looking at cases like that, which abound, it's clear right away that you have to have some kind of notion of potential antecedent. And that's an inquiry that comes pretty quickly, becomes quite intricate. So compare, do they expect to talk to each other, with who do they expect to talk to each other? Same sentence, but with who at the beginning. Well, as soon as you put who in front of it, they can't be the antecedent anymore, once again refuting the proposal. And the reason's intuitively clear. There is an antecedent for each other that's closer to it than they, but you can't hear it, it's silent. It's the unpronounced element that's in the same position as John in do they expect John to talk to each other? And it's the position of the variable in the semantic interpretation of this sentence, the one that's fed to the CI interface, which would be something like, for which person's X, they expect person's X to talk to each other. Well, person's X isn't pronounced, but that's the one that the mind sees as the antecedent. Well, investigation of these properties leads very quickly into core UG principles. These are simple illustrations of a rather general property of the sciences. It was expressed rather nicely by a Nobel laureate, Jacques Perrin. He said, the essential art of science is the reduction of complex visibles to simple invisibles. If you want to organize data, statistically analyze it, you're never going to find the invisibles, meaning you're not going to discover anything. Well, let's look a little further. Take the two sentences. They gave instructions to John to talk to each other. They received instructions from John to talk to each other. Quite different choices of antecedent in the two cases. Well, as soon as you look into these, you get into what's called the theory of control. That's the question of the structural and semantic properties that determine the interpretation of the unpronounced element that's in the same position as John, and do they expect John to talk to each other, or the variable in who do they expect to talk to each other. Here there's also one, but structural and semantic properties interact in interesting ways to determine which can be the antecedent. Well, cases such as these have been around for a long time and investigated for a long time. They show that the recent Chater Christensen proposal can't be right as it stands. But if you look into why it isn't right, you find that the non-existence approach quickly collapses because there are deep properties of UG involved. Nevertheless, there is something right about their proposal. There's an element of truth to it, namely the role of minimal structural distance. That's a significant property, quite generally. Very likely it's a case of a third factor principle of efficient computation that's appropriated by language and employed in particular ways, depending on how it interacts with the UG principles. It's the kind of thing you expect to find when you're looking at a biological system. And in fact, exploration of these counterexamples for many years has yielded a pretty rich harvest and insights into UG, and that's quite often the case. Well, let me take a look at one other example, which is a very early one, still around. This one has to do with a kind of puzzle that was noticed over half a century ago. A curious fact about language. It was never recognized in the whole thousands of years of history of the science, the subject, but it is problematic. And so take the sentence, can eagles that fly swim? Okay. Well, the question is obviously about whether eagles can swim, not about whether they can fly. That's obvious from the interpretation, but it's also clear from the morphology. So, for example, you can say, are eagles that fly swimming? But you can't say, are eagles that swimming fly? That's kind of obvious, but like a lot of obvious things, it's puzzling. It's a fine thought. Do eagles that are swimming fly? It's a fine thought, but you can't say it that way. There's something about the design of language that impedes communication by barring a simple expression of the thought and forcing some kind of circumlocution. That same property generalizes, not just for this kind of construction in every language, but also for every other construction in any language where the question arises. Now, this topic, it's sometimes called auxiliary inversion, that's spawned a small industry in computational cognitive science with many efforts to try to show that the right result can be determined by statistical analysis of a corpus in accordance with a non-existing theory, non-existence thesis. And there are new articles appearing all the time. Another one just came out a couple months ago. These proposals have interesting features. Each one that's clear enough to investigate is a failure and a dramatic, unresurrectable failure, as literature pointing this out. Furthermore, even if they succeeded, it wouldn't really matter much because the same, pretty much the same principles would give the opposite result in a language, a non-language, an invented language, which did it the other way around. And notice that the conclusion that doesn't work is computationally much simpler. Take can eagles that fly swim. The simplest computational procedure that would relate the auxiliary can to a verb would relate it to fly, the one that's nearest to it. It's a much more complex computation to get it to be associated with swim, the one that's farther. But that requires measuring structural distance, not linear distance. Linear distance is much easier to evaluate. And nevertheless, languages universally, whenever the question arises, pick the more complex operation of minimizing structural distance, not the simpler operation of minimizing linear distance. So for that reason, even if these data processing approaches came anywhere near working, which they don't, it wouldn't make any difference. Because if you had a system that used linear distance, the same approaches pretty much would say, okay, you do it by linear distance. Well, so the same question simply arises. And in the background is another question, namely how a child even knows what the intended interpretation is when it hears can eagles that fly swim. How does it know that it's supposed to rely on minimal structural distance and not the simpler operation of minimal linear distance if it has no data at all? Actually, the discovery of puzzles like this back in the 1950s is kind of reminiscent of the earliest days of modern science, right at the beginning of the Galilean period. I remember that for thousands of years, literally, scientists had been satisfied with very simple answers to obvious phenomena, like why does a rock go down if you let it go while steam rises? And there was an answer, it goes back to classical times, they're finding their natural place, end of that problem. When Galileo and others allowed themselves to be puzzled about this, that's when modern science begins. I think something similar is true here. You can be able to become puzzled about what look like simple and obvious phenomena. You find that almost nothing's understood. Everything's highly problematic. That should be familiar to cognitive scientists, but unfortunately, it's not well understood. Well, there's ample linguistic evidence that language universally makes use of minimal structural distance, not the computationally much simpler principle of linear distance. In this case, there happens to be some supporting evidence from the neurosciences. There's an interesting study in Milan which shows, considers two classes of data. Subjects are presented with two kinds of data, nonsense languages from their point of view. One of them is modeled on an existing language that they don't know, hence it satisfies principles of universal grammar. The other is modeled on an invented linear system, so it uses linear order. For example, negating a sentence by putting the negation particle after the third word. That's a computationally trivial principle, much simpler than the one that's actually used. Well, it turns out, and these studies indicate, that when you look at brain activity, the subjects who are looking at the nonsense language modeled on UG, you get the normal activation in the language areas, in Broca's area and so on. When you look at the linear system, you don't get that activation. There's activation elsewhere, which suggests that the subjects are just treating it as a puzzle of some kind, trying to figure out an answer to this strange puzzle, but it's not evoking the linguistic systems. That's a difficult but potentially quite rich research area. Well, all of this conforms quite well to the little that we know about evolution. I'll come back to that. It also provides a plausible explanation for the fact that the child reflexively goes for the right answer, minimal structural distance. Namely, linear order is simply not available to the language learner confronted with such examples. It's not part of the core of language. It's something on the side. Well, a simpler and more general principle would be that linear order is never available in eye language, apart from externalization to the sensory motor system, where, of course, it's required. That's the far-reaching thesis that I mentioned before in connection with binding theory. So the thesis, that's the thesis that order and other arrangements are some peripheral part of language related to externalization at the sensory motor system where it's required, so it's sort of a reflex of that. But it doesn't enter into core computational processes that yield the structure of the language and the meaning of sentences, conceptual intentional interface. That thesis is conceptually quite natural and has considerable empirical support, some problems as always. But assuming that the general thesis can be upheld, it would follow that particular uses of language that depend on externalization, among them communication, are even more peripheral aspects of language. That's contrary to a very widely held beliefs, in fact, so widespread as to be virtual dogma, but without empirical support, as far as I know, and with plenty of evidence against them, like this. It would also follow that the extensive literature on what's called language evolution is just starting in the wrong place. It's looking in the wrong, under the wrong lamppost. It's looking at communication, but that's something way on the side and peripheral to language. And there's substantial independent evidence for that general thesis, in part having to do with evolutionary considerations, but more significantly, based on fundamental properties of language design, which I'll return to in a moment. But let me first mention that the existence thesis, the one I think is correct, of course, does not entail that there's no interaction of UG with other cognitive processes in acquisition and use of language, presumably is. Going back to the 1950s, my own earliest work on this topic assumed that it must be involved. And you think about language acquisition, the first task of an infant is to select out of the famous booming, buzzing confusion, to select out that data which is language related. That's quite a non-trivial task, but it's somehow done. Infant does it, no other organism does. And very quickly, in fact, we now know even prenatally, the infant recognizes at least something of the prosodic patterns, pitch and stress patterns. That's done very early, undoubtedly by UG principles. And they work further so that after a couple of months, the general prosody of the language is known and other things come along, all reflexively by UG principles. However, there's an early task, fairly early task, namely selecting words out of running discourse. How do you do that? My own work back in the 50s assumed that that was done by investigating transitional probabilities. Transitional probabilities go down at the end of a word, obviously. So if you looked at those, you ought to be able to get word boundaries. In fact, back in 1955, when I wrote about it, I assumed that this is necessary because there didn't seem to be any other evidence. Well, the matter turns out to be more complex and more interesting. There's recent work that shows that that method actually fails, to my surprise, everyone's surprise. But the results improve very sharply when estimation of transitional probabilities interacts with other principles. So a six-month-old infant, according to these studies, segments into elements with word-like properties when statistical properties are aligned with prosodically organized speech, apparently UG-based processes. The non-existence thesis, as I mentioned, keeps to, of course, presupposes genetic endowment, but it keeps to aspects of genetic endowment that are language independent, and I think it's fair to say that it hasn't gotten anywhere. In contrast, inquiry into the existence thesis relies on a different principle, namely third factor principles of computational efficiency, and I think that's registered many successes. The earliest work in universal grammar, about in the 1950s, postulated extremely rich systems, rich UG. That seemed necessary in order to achieve a kind of a modicum of descriptive adequacy, but it was clear right away that that didn't make much sense. And the main thrust of linguistic theoretical work in linguistics, at least within the generative enterprise for the last roughly 50 years, is to try to reduce the assumptions about UG, to simplify them to as simple a form as you can get. Now, there are two reasons for that. One's just general rational inquiry. You want to eliminate stipulations and rich assumptions. You get deeper explanations that way. Now, the other reason, specific to language, is that one would hope that it's a necessity if there's ever going to be a serious study of evolution of language. The target of those studies is UG. That's what evolved. And the more complex it is, the more unlikely it is that anything will ever be learned about this. In contrast, if it indeed is very simple, as could be the case, you can imagine how it might have evolved. Well, I won't run through the history of these efforts, but I'll just say something about where I think we are now. I think we've now reached a point where assumptions about UG are simple enough. They don't cover everything by any means, of course, but it's possible to speculate reasonably that language actually satisfies an extremely strong thesis, sometimes called the strong minimalist thesis. That is the thesis that language is perfectly designed to satisfy the conceptual intentional interface. There's already reasons which I've mentioned, I'll come back to others, why it doesn't matter much about the sensory motor interface, but perfectly designed to satisfy the conceptual intentional interface. That's the strong minimalist thesis it opens a research effort, look at actual languages and see how much they depart from this thesis, then explore the discrepancy, see if you can reduce it by a deeper analysis of what's involved. And the residue that resists that analysis, well, that's essentially UG. There's a separate development from the early years of the generative enterprise, which I'll mention. That has to do with language acquisition. The early approaches to UG assumed that UG provides a kind of a format for grammars, for I languages, with infinitely many possible instantiations, and then there has to be some kind of evaluation procedure that selects among them given data, selects among them on the basis basically of shortness of grammar. That's a notion that developed independently later in computer science for other reasons. Well, that in principle yields what's called a discovery procedure for language, a way to get to a language from data, but it's totally unfeasible. It's astronomical search involved. That's one of the many problems of abduction. Around 1980, a different approach developed, principles and parameters approach, which tried to eliminate that problem by looking at language in a different way, and not as at UG, not as a format for possible grammars, but as a fixed set of principles with a set of kind of like a set of a questionnaire associated with it, which finite questions which have to be answered. Child has to answer those questions. Is it a, you know, verb initial language, verb final language, and so on? And if you answer those finite set of questions, you ought to get an I language. Well, that conceptual shift led to it led to rich research of unprecedented scope and depth into a very wide typological range of languages, just way beyond anything that had been done before. It revitalized psycholinguistic inquiry with highly productive explorations of acquisition and use of parameters, and also opened the way to new approaches to historical change. Well, whatever approach to language acquisition one takes, these questions are going to arise. I mean, either the approach assumes an infinite array of possible outcomes, in which case they're hopeless abductive problems, or else it assumes a finite array of possible outcomes, in which case it falls within the principles and parameters approach. Well, let me return to the recursive component of the I language, the generative process that generates an infinite array of hierarchically structured expressions, maps them to the interfaces. The SMT, the strong minimalist thesis, postulates that this generative procedure should be based on the simplest possible combinatorial operation. That's an operation that's embedded in some fashion in any computational process. That's an operation, I'll call it merge, which takes two objects that have already been formed and constructs from them a new object. So you've already constructed X and Y, the merge constructs Z. That's somewhere in every computational procedure. The principle of minimizing computation, which is an overriding third factor principle, that entails that in the course of the operation, you don't change X and Y, and you don't assign any order to them, which means that merge of X and Y will just give the set X, Y, no order, keeping them as they were. Well, I've already mentioned that there's pretty good reason to think that order isn't part of this operation. That seems to be a reflex of externalization, peripheral to language. But if you look further, you find more. So just think about the logical possibilities for merge of X and Y. One possibility is that X and Y that they're separate from one another. Neither is part of the other. Now that's called external merge. So it's like taking the syntactic internal object corresponding to, say, read and to books and putting them together and getting the object corresponding to read books, the set read and books. Now that's called external merge. Well, the other possibility is that one of them is part of the other, say Y is part of X. And if you think about that, if Y is part of X and you merge Y to X, again you get the set XY, but this time there are two copies of Y, one of them internal to X, one of them the new one that you've merged to it. That simply follows from minimal computation, not changing anything. But if you think about it, that yields the property of displacement, a universal property of languages. So for example, in What Did You See, the word what actually has two functions. It's the object of see, like see that, but it's also a quantificational, an operator, quantificational element that is an operator ranging over the whole expression. Well, if that's exactly what's generated by internal merge, what's generated is what did you see what, which is interpreted at the conceptual intentional level as for which X you saw X. The same thing is true of that binding theory example that I gave. Who do they expect to see each other? Who is externally merged in the operator position, in the object position of C, it's internally merged, the whole clause, you get two copies, it's exactly the way you interpret it. Who did you expect who to see? John, each other, and the internal who's got to be the antecedent. That's all over the place. It gives you the not only gives you the properties of displacement, but it gives them to you in a form which feeds the sensory motor interface, the sensory intentional interface, the semantic interface. Notice that although that's pretty much perfect, it works for very complex cases. I won't talk about other ones. It's pretty much the right answer for how to generate the meaning of the sentence, the CI interface, but it's completely wrong for the sensory motor interface. Universally in language, the copies are deleted except for the hierarchically most prominent one, which is an interesting class of exceptions which supports the conclusion. So we don't say who do they expect who to see each other, we expect who do they expect to see each other. And that's universal, all languages, I mean, no question about it. And in fact, that follows from another principle of minimal computation, namely pronounce as little as possible. Well, there are pretty far-reaching conclusions to this if you think it through. The simplest operation possible, merge, meeting the condition of minimal computation, essentially gives the right meaning, but gives the wrong form. And those of you who've worked on parsing problems or perception problems, notice that that's a large part of the problem that arises in parsing and perception. It's what are called filler gap problems. You hear the word who at the beginning of a sentence, you gotta figure out where the gap is that it's somehow related to. There wouldn't be any problem if you pronounced it, some problems, but not most of them. So what we see is that language design from examples like these, which are all over the place, is very well suited for semantic interpretation, but very harmful for communication and perception and use. Well, notice that's the same conclusion. Language design is oriented towards the thought systems, CI, and the sensory motor system, externalization of the sensory motor system is kind of tacked on afterwards. And again, communication is just some peripheral aspect of language. And wherever there are conflicts, everyone I've ever found, between communicative efficiency and computational efficiency, computational efficiency wins hands down, not by a small amount, but just overwhelmingly, like in this case. That's true of lots of things, ambiguities, garden path sentences, they just seem to work by letting the rules run free. Interesting class of cases is what are called islands. That is, expressions where there's a fine thought, but you can't express it. Kind of like the one about are eels that flying swim. So take, say, the sentence, they asked if the mechanics fixed the car, fixed the cars. There are two questions you can ask about this. You can ask how many cars and how many mechanics. So how many cars did they ask if the mechanics fixed? How many mechanics did they ask if fixed the cars? Well, obviously they have a very different status. The second one, how many mechanics did they ask if fixed the cars? That's a fine thought, but you just can't say it. You have to have some circumlocution to get to it. Another case where the design of language is harming communication. And if you look into it closely, it's a plausible explanation in terms of minimizing computation. And in fact, as I said, every case that's been discovered of conflicts between communicative and computational efficiency always wins, and it yields pretty much the right semantic interpretations. Well, if that generalizes as far as it seems to, it means that Aristotle's common sense dictum, language is sound with a meaning, should really be reversed. Language is meaning with a sound, sometimes. maybe a sign, maybe nothing. But it's basically a system of thought, a system of meaning, system for expressing thoughts. It's a very different conception, has plenty of consequences, not only with regard to language, but with regard to cognitive architecture generally. Well, let me turn at last to evolution of language. That's been a pretty hot topic lately, judging by the number of publications that pour out constantly, all the time. Which purport to be about evolution of language. And I stress the phrase purport to be because they're not about evolution of language. If you take a look at them, they're speculations, of course, about evolution of communication. That's quite different from communication, from evolution of language. Totally different. So whatever they may be, they're not about evolution of language. It's also worth just bearing in mind something that ought to be obvious. Language doesn't evolve. Language isn't a biological entity that evolves. People evolve. So there's evolution of the species, and that means of properties of the species, but not evolution of language. And there are some things that we know about it. For example, we don't know a lot about evolution, in fact, very little, but there's some things that we know. So, for example, it's pretty well established that there has been no evolution of linguistic capacity for about 50,000 years, approximately the time when some human started leaving Africa. Evidence for that is overwhelming. If you take an infant from some Amazonian tribe that's had no human contact, bring them up in, say, Boston, from the beginning, kid'll be indistinguishable from my grandchildren, and conversely, which means they've got the same linguistic capacities. That means there's been no evolution of these capacities for essentially 50,000 years. If you go back, there are individual differences, but no group differences that are known. Well, if you go back roughly 50 or 100,000 years before that, there's no evidence that language existed at all. Somewhere in that small window, from an evolutionary point of view, a very small window, and notice long after separation from any other living species, surviving species, somewhere in that window something critical happened. And there's evidence for it in the archaeological record. In that window you do get, say, 75,000 years ago, plus or minus, there does seem to have been a sudden explosion of creative activity, complex social organization, symbolic behavior of all kinds, artistic and others, records of astronomical events and a whole variety of things, what Jared Diamond once called a great leap forward. Paleoanthropologists always assume quite plausibly that this must have something to do with the emergence of language, which gave us the ability to do that. That's very plausible. And there appears to have been no relevant evolutionary change since that time. You know, you can fiddle around with the numbers, like double the numbers if you like, or whatever you like. It leads to essentially the same conclusion. Essentially, no evolutionary change since this happened, and it happened pretty suddenly from an evolutionary point of view. Well, what this suggests pretty strongly is that at some moment, at some point inside this narrow window, a generative process emerged in some individual. Mutations take place in an individual, not a group. So somebody, some maybe slight rewiring of the brain, we don't know enough about the brain to tell, but some slight rewiring of the brain might have yielded a generative process. Process, if this person was capable of mapping that generative process onto pre-existing concepts, and that's a tricky question in itself, but if it was capable of doing this, it would have a language of thought, what's called a language of thought. It would have an infinite array of expressions, each of which has an interpretation. It'd be the only person in the small group, you know, hunter-gatherer group, to have this property. Well, that may provide some selectional advantage. It's be partially transmitted to offspring. its small selectional advantages can, obviously can expand over a group. It's not so simple, it's rare, but it can happen. And if it did happen, then maybe this enough people in that small group would have the internal thought language so that it would make sense to figure out a way to externalize it so that they could interact with one another with their thoughts. Well, that poses a problem, hard cognitive problem. It's the problem of matching. Incidentally, at the initial state, when this process developed, it had no selectional pressures, right? It's just something happening in some individual. So therefore, you'd expect it to develop, to take the form, a form that's simply dictated by natural law, kind of like a snowflake. There's no selectional pressures. It would just be a perfect system having this property. Well, that's the strong minimalist thesis. So what you'd expect is that you would get some system that satisfies the strong minimalist thesis, maps onto the conceptual intentional system, yields a language of thought, no externalization. Later on, when you face the problem of externalization, you're facing a hard cognitive problem, actually a problem that every infant has to solve, every one. You have to relate two systems that have nothing to do with one another. The sensory motor system had apparently been around for hundreds of thousands of years without any detectable change, and you got to somehow relate data coming out of that with an internal system that's kind of like a snowflake, you know, a perfectly designed system. That's a hard problem. As I say, it's the problem that a child has to solve. And since children do it so fast, they must be specifically designed to do it. And that problem can be solved in many different ways. In fact, that is the domain in which you get variety among languages. They differ in sound systems to some extent, in morphology, you know, inflection, word order, things like that. In fact, when you're learning a second language, that's all you learn. You never learn the syntax and the semantics. For one reason, nobody knows enough to teach it to you. And for another reason, you already know it. That's built in. And in fact, it's very likely that it comes out essentially the same for all languages. But the externalization does differ. That's the complicated part. That's what you have to pick up when you're learning, you know, Yoruba or something. And it's hard work for an adult, at least. For an infant, it's quite different. It's the area in which languages differ. It's also the area in which languages are subject to quick change. So, for example, say the Norman conquest led to big changes in the externalization, not as far as we know in either the semantics or the core syntax. In fact, that may never change. That looks like this would lead to the conclusion that I mentioned before, that externalizations and communication even more so are peripheral parts of language, ancillary parts, and that the system in its core design, you know, no design or anything, the normal sense of design, is designed to approach as much as possible the strong minimalist thesis and to be oriented towards a system of thought. Well, that come back to some of the current, I mentioned before the widespread belief, quoted again, that there are well-developed gradualist evolutionary arguments that language is entirely grounded in a constellation of cognitive capacities with different functions. In fact, there are no such arguments. And furthermore, there's no reason to expect any. It would be a big surprise if there were any, so it's not surprising that they aren't. The reason for the belief, I think, traces back to some pretty odd misconceptions about evolution generally, natural selection, namely that everything has to happen in, you know, small steps. I mean, maybe that's what you learn in eighth grade, but that's not the way evolution works. Well-known cases, not a no surprise to biologists these days, that there are very sharp changes from very small, you know, shift around the operation of some regulatory mechanisms, get a different species, you know, and there's plenty of examples of that. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if some minor rewiring of the brain, which we don't know enough about to identify, led to a system of a generative process mapping onto the conceptual intentional system, leaving a cognitive leaving a hard problem to solve, namely how you relate it to the sensory motor system. Whether it happened or not, it's not at all surprising to, from a biological point of view, and it's rather striking that leading evolutionary biologists like François Jacob and Salvador Luria and Harry Jarrison and others have kind of taken for granted that something like this happened. Well, if there is a last point I'd like to make about this. If this general approach is correct, there are really two core properties to an I language, to the essential of language. One is the generative procedure, maybe close to perfect, you know, maybe based on a, say, approaching the SMT. That's one. The other is the mapping to the interfaces. Now, if the general approach is correct, each of these is pretty simple in itself. When you put them together, you get a human language. But in themselves, they're pretty simple, if this is correct. And therefore, you would anticipate that they might appear elsewhere in the evolutionary record. In fact, maybe it happened, you know, maybe a generative process developed endless numbers of times in the human lineage for the last million years, but only one of them caught on, you know, caught on by being attached to a mapping to the interface and then everything else. And maybe it happened in other lineages. So that does raise a question. Can you look at the comparative evidence and find cases where there is something analogous to a mapping to the conceptual intentional interface, something like, you know, mapping to meaning, roughly, and separately from that, sudden emergence of a generative procedure? Well, the first part, mapping to the interface, there's a sense in which that's routine. So if you take, say, virtually any animal communication system, say, birds singing a vervet call or whatever, you know, say a warning call. A warning call is a symbol which has a particular interpretation. It says, you know, run, because maybe there's an eagle coming. Maybe, I don't know if that's what the monkey thinks, but it has that function at least. And that's true of animal communication generally. So there's something roughly, very roughly analogous to a mapping to the CI interface and of course to the sensory motor interface. I mean, there's a noise produced. Next question, is there anything analogous to the appearance of a generative procedure without a mapping to the interface? Well, up until now, nothing remotely similar has been discovered, but you'd expect it. And there's one recent experiment which is at least suggestive. You may have seen it. A lot of hoopla about it recently, mostly misinterpreted. But there was an interesting experiment done by some Japanese bird scientists working with finches who claim to, what they say is, if you read the paper in Nature, that they found something similar to a context-free grammar with the way bird calls were embedded and in one another and so on. Actually, if you look at the data set, they didn't really find it. They didn't do the right experiments. But if that were correct, if you could continue the experiments, and if you could get that result, notice that it would be a pretty strong argument supporting the general approach that I'm talking about. If it's true that language developed from a simple rewiring, which gave the optimal a computational system, there's no particular reason why that couldn't have happened in a lot of independent lineages. There's no evolutionary relationship, but just normal convergence, which happens all over the place. So it's in a way to be expected. This experiment unfortunately doesn't quite show it, but it indicates what you might discover, which is a suggestive area to look at. It's an area where comparative evidence might actually provide some insight into human language. Actually, there's very little that exists that does that. Well, I'll stop here. This discussion barely scratches the surface, but I hope it gives some indication of what can maybe reasonably be proposed, reasonably plausible today, and what one might want to search for in the future. Thanks.
Hello? Yes. Regarding the mechanism for
Barbara.
Universal grammar and acquisition of language.
Yeah, I don't hear too well, so I have to translate.
Do you see the same sort of mechanism being used for acquisition of other human skills, such as singing and dancing and sports and cooking and so on? Would they utilize the same mechanism that language uses, or would language need a whole special different type of mechanism for acquisition of that's different from those other human generative sort of activities like singing and dancing and cooking and sports and playing golf and so on? They're all generative, but they're different from language. Yeah. Do you see them using the same mechanism, or is language a totally different mechanism?
Well, you know, then, I mean, that's, you know, singing and dance seem to be pretty close to cultural universals, as far as we know. When people say that they're generative, it's not very clear what that means. I mean, in a sense, everything is generative. You know, anything you can describe at all that's digital, you can write a Turing machine program for it, you know, a program for your laptop, let's say, which will generate it. I mean, that's true. There's a lot of confusion about the notion of generative, recursive, and so on. Roughly speaking, any program you can write for your laptop gives a generative procedure, even if it produces one output, period, produces the number one. That's a recursive function. And these systems have some kind of structure and organization, but it's very hard to show, and I don't know of any way to show it, that they yield a digital infinity of structured entities. That's tricky, and I don't know of any example like that. Furthermore, that's not enough. In order for the core of language, you have to have a structured, an array, an infinite array of structured expressions, each of which gets an interpretation at the interface. There's nothing like that in these cases that anyone knows. They're just kind of very rough analogies. I mean, it's kind of a little like saying there's nothing special about insect navigation. Proof, I can usually find my way home at night. So a bee is just a more evolved human, you know, a little better than I am, but essentially the same thing. I mean, I don't really think these are sensible arguments. In fact, we never make those arguments about anything except human capacity, which ought to raise a question. But I just don't see anything beyond the very rough analogies.
It seems I didn't understand quite your argument about the evolution, so I would like to ask you to clarify this a little bit. So you are saying that there was, by chance, one individual in the world that got these mutations and had the capacity of universal grammar. But there was no selective pressure on the survival of this organism. So how then it's possible that this one single individual would survive and give all these generations, and so all of us must be ancestors of this single organism, even though there was no any kind of pressure from outside that this universal should survive and provide all these genes and all this capacity of universal grammar.
Given that you argued that there was one very saltatory change, but there was no selective pressure, how is it that can then generalize?
Well, the fact that there was a single small change and it was under no selective pressure, that's pretty close to tautology. It's hard to imagine an alternative to that. I mean, at some stage, let's pick some numbers, 100,000 years ago, which is a reasonable guess, our ancestors had no generative procedure. 50,000 years ago, all of them had the same generative procedure. And as I said, there's been no evolution since then. So that tells us that somewhere in that window, something happened. Well, what happened? There isn't much time for extensive selectional pressures. It's not, you know, millions of years. So something happened. What happened, you know, just ordinary scientific method tells us we should ask whether what happened is the smallest possible change that could have happened. Well, the smallest possible change that could have happened is the emergence of this combinatorial operation, merge, the simplest possible combinatorial operation. And that happened in an individual, because that's how mutations take place. They don't take place in groups. So some individual, this is tautology, virtual tautology. Some individual developed that operation, maybe some tiny rewiring of the brain. There were no selectional pressures because it's something internal to a single individual. So it would have taken the form of something like a snowflake, something determined completely by natural law. There's really no alternative to that. And if it can be linked to the thought system, that's a crucial part, you get a language of thought which is essentially perfect, given the exigencies of whatever the conceptual system is. Well, that much is pretty close to tautology. How does that diversify into the vast range of languages and so on? Well, there we raise an empirical question, crucial one. How much of that is due to the externalization process? As I mentioned, the externalization process is a hard cognitive task. You have to relate something coming out of the sensory motor system, which has been around for hundreds of thousands of years, which no change as far as anyone knows. You have to relate that to this internal sort of snowflake. Well, that's hard. You can do it in a lot of ways. We know that it appears to vary. Of course, not arbitrarily. There are many constraints. We also know that children have special design to solve this problem very rapidly. There's pretty strong evidence that it's solved very quickly. So there's some special design in solving it, but there are a lot of different ways to solve it, and that's what we call different languages. But that's all peripheral to the core semantic and syntactic principles. Let me mention again what everyone knows, but people often don't think about the consequences. Suppose you're trying to teach somebody, say, Italian. They don't know Italian. You teach them the phonetics, the phonology, the morphology, the word order, a couple of other things like that. You do not teach them the principles that yield such consequences as the binding examples that I gave. You don't teach that. You don't teach them that the analog to can eagles that swim fly refers to can they fly, not swim. You don't teach them a quantificational structure. You don't teach them the islands. In fact, you couldn't teach them any of that stuff because almost nobody knows anything about it. And if you did try to teach it, it would just confuse them. So what you teach them is the peripheral parts. The rest of it, somehow, they've already know, which suggests that it's just in there somewhere, and it's hard to imagine an alternative to saying that it's something quite simple. Now, you have to prove it, of course, but that's what would be anticipated on evolutionary grounds. It's commonly thought that the evolutionary arguments go in the opposite direction, that since there's all this diversity, there must have been a long period of selection. There's no evidence for any of that, and it's contrary to what the logic of the evolutionary argument actually indicates. So if you want to take evolutionary speculation seriously, it seems to me this is what they lead to.